Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On October 7th of last year, backed by a barrage of rockets, Hamas terrorists stormed from the blockaded Gaza Strip into nearby Israeli towns, leaving over 1,000 people dead and abducting others. Israel has been responding ever since with airstrikes and military raids into Gaza. That death toll is estimated at over 35,000. In the United States, this has led to protests on college campuses, divided student bodies, and have even brought about arrest. Frontline on PBS with Retro Report gives us the inside story of what's driving the protests, the chants, and the accusations of anti-Semitism over Israel and the war in Gaza. The team investigates the polarizing debate over free speech and the political forces behind the crisis. We're joined by James Jacoby. He's the director and producer and correspondent for Frontline. His latest film is Frontline's Crisis on Campus. And James, welcome back to The Source.
Thank you so much for having me again.
So let's just, you know, you guys draw a very narrow lane of what you're going to be looking at. You're not arguing about or looking at what's going on in Gaza and Israel. You're looking about what's happening on the campuses. And that seems to be where, for lack of a better term, where the battleground is right now, right?
Yes, I mean, it's certainly one battleground. My previous film was about Benjamin Netanyahu, and we looked at kind of how we got to this war in Gaza. But this film in particular is about what's been happening on American college campuses since October 7th. And, you know, it's a narrow lane, but it's in and of itself, it's a very wide lane. You know, and having covered the actual conflict and now this kind of conflict over the conflict, there's layers and layers of complexity on what's happening on the story on college campuses, you know, political forces and other things at work here.
When Hamas attacked Israel, it was easy to predict, and you have that in the report, that Israel was going to respond with overwhelming force and a death toll. That's easily, you know, you didn't have to be a soothsayer to know that was going to happen. But was it predictable that this would have erupted on college campuses in the United States?
It's a great question. Was it predictable? I don't think so. I don't think it was predictable. No. And I think that part of why we were drawn to cover the story and cover it really from the start filming from the very beginning was because right away it was sort of surprising. I mean, really the spark for this kind of crisis on campuses was the fact that right in the immediate aftermath of the October 7th attack, which of course that attack was unpredictable, but then you had right in the immediate aftermath kind of pro-Palestinian student groups at universities across the country, most notably at Harvard University, issuing statements trying to kind of contextualize the Hamas attack in a broader framework of what's been happening in Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians. And I think then that engendered a reaction, and then you had action, reaction to where this really cascaded to kind of get us to the present day when we've seen, you know, confrontations with police,
right,
protesters, hearings, all of the above.
So I'm going to play a clip from the Crisis on Campus Frontline that airs tonight on PBS. This is a clip of the Harvard Palestinian organizers talking about the letter. And I think this is really insightful. And I'm so glad you have this in your report. Let's give a listen.
So we felt like it was necessary to get out some sort of statement, like, immediately, because we saw what was happening and we felt like there were two, like, really urgent needs. One was to, like, contextualize what's happening. And two, we were scared and we felt like there was a real urgent need to warn people to stand in unwavering, you know, solidarity against retaliation that was going to kill thousands of people.
The statement, signed by a coalition of more than 30 student groups at Harvard, began with the line, We, the undersigned student organizations, hold the Israeli regime entirely responsible for all unfolding violence. There was no mention of Hamas.
It's this idea of, like, if something horrific happens, why and what are the circumstances that lead someone to do something like this? And where does that responsibility lie? And when we're talking about Palestine and the circumstances in which Palestinians are living, it's they are living under Israeli oppression. And what is happening is they're in a pressure cooker. And you think, what is a response that could occur in this pressure cooker?
Did you contemplate whether to mention Hamas at all?
It just didn't really seem like the purpose of our statement. Like, I think, again, we wanted to contextualize it in a broader structure. I think Hamas is a, like, manifestation of the structure.
So, James, help us still unpack, why does Hamas get a pass? Why do they feel like this is entirely Israel's fault and Hamas has no responsibility for this attack?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, are they saying that Hamas, I mean, yes, I guess they're saying Hamas has no responsibility, and that is indeed why there's been such a vociferous reaction to student statements like that. And in fact, the Harvard statement was rather mild compared to some other student statements that came out at other universities that sort of stood by the resistance, the Palestinian resistance, and kind of in some ways legitimizing Hamas as a resistance, as opposed to a kind of terrorist organization. So this is why indeed this was a controversial statement and sparked this crisis. I think that, as you heard from their perspective, and these are three Palestinian women that are at Harvard Law School, they weren't, I mean, even though they were assigning blame to Israel for all unfolding violence, I think they were trying to contextualize that in a broader historical context. And, is it to say that they're pro-Hamas, which they've been painted as and by various voices in the media and elsewhere, that's not something that they're even, that I certainly don't think they are.
Well, how can they not be pro-Hamas if they don't want to hold Hamas accountable for the attack? I mean, it seems...
I mean, I think that, yeah, that's very tricky. They're basically not wanting to weigh in on Hamas, right? They left Hamas out of the statement, and they haven't really wanted to hold Hamas accountable or responsible. And I think that really what they're trying to do is skirt the issue.
That's very convenient for them.
Yes, it's convenient for them, and it's a very problematic part of the movement.
Your report, of course, you're just focusing on campus, and you don't even get into the deep history of Hamas and how they have control of Gaza and what they do in Gaza and whether or not Hamas knew that they were going to be putting tens of thousands of the lives, they were going to sacrifice lives of people in Gaza because they launched that attack. You know, everyone knew that was going to happen. So, but they're not responsible for that, according to these student organizers. So we're going to continue talking about this. Our phone lines are open. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. What do you think is behind these student protests? What do they want to accomplish? Are they accomplishing that? And how do we move forward in a positive way? 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Universities are seen as a center for expressing diverse opinions. We frequently see youthful activism, often reflecting in broader social conflicts and debates, usually robust and healthy. But since the Israeli-Hamas conflict broke out into open warfare, things have escalated, and there have been There's been a firestorm of conflict, setting student groups against each other. We've seen encampments spring up, buildings being occupied, and then the police coming onto campus, arresting, sometimes very violently, the students. And there's been a lot of hate-filled rhetoric, frequently anti-Semitic rhetoric, and Islamophobic as well. So where are we with this conflict? How did this happen? We're joined by James Dickapy. He's the director, producer, and correspondent for Frontline. His latest film is Crisis on Campus. It airs tonight on PBS stations, 9 o'clock Central, and then it will stream online after the broadcast on the PBS app and on YouTube and on their website. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So James, let's talk about the chants that they use. Mm-hmm. And you focus that, you highlight that in the reporting, and let's give a listen to how that sounds.
Some on the issue of Israel.
People over probably 40, maybe 50, watched Israel or understand that Israel was, first of all, created out of the ashes of the Holocaust and then attacked and was sort of the underdog in 48 and again in 67. They had these fights for survival, but what the younger folks have grown up with is Israel as a mature country that has the most powerful military in the region, and they see Israel as a bully.
We don't want no two states.
We want 48.
We want 48.
As they had been doing on their campuses, the protesters in D.C. were using provocative chants with meanings that were being highly contested. One was for Global Intifada, or Uprising, which many of the students embraced as a call for Palestinian liberation after decades of occupation.
Intifada Revolution!
Intifada Revolution!
For pro-Israel students, it was a call for violence, evoking years of Palestinian terror attacks against Jews.
Intifada Revolution!
Another was for Palestine to be liberated from the river to the sea.
That's the main chant. That's the main chant of the Palestinian liberation struggle.
So these chants, you have to, and you bring it up in the reporting that some of these students, that means something to some of them and something else to others?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, these chants are kind of open to interpretation to some extent, but also they do mean things. You know, the river to the sea chant is as well as the globalize or localize the Intifada chants are, you know, as you just heard, they can be taken by Jewish students, Israeli students, as a call to eradicate Israel from the river to the sea and reestablish Palestine from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. But a lot of the people that are chanting it mean something different. They mean equal rights and freedom from occupation from the river to the sea. I mean, there's a lot of interpretations, and so we kind of get in the film, we hear from a number of different people about how they see and react to these chants.
I would argue that if someone is chanting something, that they have a responsibility to understand the context of that chant. And from the river to the sea is clearly, you know, it's about, they want the elimination of Israel as a state. That's what that is about.
Well, yes, that's true. I mean, that's but I think you'd be hard pressed to find that the majority of these students actually do know what they're chanting when they're saying from the river to the sea and how that might be heard. I mean, we should note that obviously from the river to the sea is a controversial statement on both sides. The Likud party in Israel has it as, you know, as kind of from the river to the sea, there'll be a greater Israel, which of course is controversial, but from the same, same token.
Yeah, that means the elimination of Gaza as a state.
Yes, it means that. It means, you know, forever occupation of the West Bank. It means a lot of things. So, yes, I would agree with you, though, that, that this is a very controversial chant, and two, that a lot of the students don't necessarily know exactly what they're chanting for, and one could say that they're irresponsible.
Yeah, and so that's been a criticism that some have lobbed at these students, that they don't understand what they're protesting. They don't understand what they're chanting. They have been, activated by seeing the horrific images of the bodies of the children, the conditions in Gaza, you know, on social media, but they don't know a lot more than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things about covering this story has been about how what could be and what is in part a movement to try to get a ceasefire in this war, because people are seeing this destruction and death in Gaza as a result of Israel's response to October 7th. There's the calls for a ceasefire. There's a call to end this war and to stop the killing and destruction. That has been folded in to larger movements that have existed for a long time, pro-Palestinian movements. That's where these chants are coming from. These aren't chants that are anti-war chants. These are chants for Palestinian liberation on the larger context of the conflict between Israel and Palestinians. And so this has all gotten folded together. So I think the messages often get muddled because you have these controversial chants about something that's much more of an existential question in the Middle East that hasn't been solved in terms of solutions, two-state solution, what have you, but mixed into the outrage over the war and the humanitarian crisis and calls for a ceasefire. So in some ways, it's muddled the movement.
Let's go to a caller, and our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And we have Zara on the line. And Zara, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. My call is that Hamas is following Iranian government order. Why is nobody talking about that? I feel very bad for Palestinians that more than 200 died, and also for Israelian, and all is Iranian government is should be accountable for that, and nobody talk about that. Would you please explain it to me? Thank you.
All right. Well, the topic is about the crisis on campus. That's the name of the Frontline documentary, and how what's going on with the Israel-Hamas war has become such a volatile topic on campus, and it brought about questions of free speech and the right to protest on campus. And then also we'll get further on down the line about how some in Washington, D.C. have co-opted that as well for their own political agenda. So we're not really getting into, you know, the deep roots of Hamas and Iran and other issues as well. But James, if you wanted to jump on that.
Yeah, I will say, as you said, that's not the subject of the documentary, but I think that, you know, we were talking about there certainly are people that are part of the movement out there in the protests that have said some surprising things about, you know, for instance, that were upset about Israel's response to the Iran's recent attempt with the drone attacks and things like that. And then obviously weighing in on what's happened with the Yemenis and the Houthis, there's the caller is kind of bringing something up, which is that in the protest movement, there are some elements of it that are sympathetic with you know, whether it be Hamas or the Iranians or the Houthis. That's a dynamic that exists. And I certainly don't want to paint that with a broad brush. It's probably a very small contingent, but if that relates to this story at all, that's how it would relate.
Okay, another caller. We have Rhoda. And Rhoda, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm kind of traumatized by this whole thing, and I hate to introduce my trauma. So I'll just mention that I'm 74 years old. When I was a kid, I got more stones thrown at me. As an adult, I was denied certain jobs and also certain places to live where they didn't allow Jews. But that was then, and this is now. And I think people don't understand what a Jew is. I was on the phone the other day, I don't remember what for, but they were asking me, are you white? Are you black? And I said, I'm Jewish. They said, no, that's not a race. I said, actually, it is. And it's very complicated for people because there are many different reasons for Judaism. There's the Jews that are Orthodox and hold very closely to what God has told them. And there are the Jews that died in World War II.
Okay. Rhoda, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate that. So, James, the call very moving, but it gives us some context to why there is the reaction that we're seeing.
Yes, there's no doubt, and I think it's something that in reporting this story, we couldn't help but engage in the reporting about questions of Zionism and anti-Zionism. Zionism, of course, the movement that was, intended to establish a Jewish homeland in its ancestral Israel, in Palestine, and that a lot of the protests are what they call anti-Zionist. They claim not to be anti-Semitic, meaning that they're not targeting or it's not hatred directed toward Jews, but rather it's hatred. It's rather a movement against Zionism, against the establishment of Israel and this in this territory. And I think that's a very, very tricky hornet's nest, especially for Jews, and especially, as the caller said, for religious Jews, where this is seen as biblical Israel, and there's a deep attachment to Israel, both among people that would be self-proclaimed Zionist Jews or non-Zionist people
but also as a place, a nation where Jewish people can live without, the harassments and prejudices that Rhoda told us about.
Absolutely, and a refuge from persecution, which is why it was set up in the first place in the ashes of the Holocaust. So it's a deeply emotional and complicated topic, and I think it certainly has animated a lot of the anger on campuses among Jewish students and others, and a desire for these schools to respond what they see as appropriately and kind of try to distance themselves from students that are basically crossing the blurry line between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism.
But Rhoda mentioned, the Holocaust and October 7th being the worst day since the Holocaust for, the loss of Jewish life.
Yes, and the film starts with October 7th with a student at Harvard University, a Jewish student named Shabbos Kestenbaum, who broke the Sabbath for the first day in his life, checked his cell phone to see, whether his family members were alive. And it's extremely poignant. And for him then to be confronted with the student statement at his own university holding Israel responsible for the attacks and for all unfolding violence was deeply disturbing to him and many others.
Yeah, it's important as we have these conversations that we keep the humanity, the people up front and in focus, and as we look for, some common grounds. We're going to continue our conversation after this break. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues Crisis on Campus after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the newest episode of Frontline, PBS's documentary series. Tonight, it's Crisis on Campus. Frontline with Retro Report have been following the escalating turmoil since the war, since the October 7th attack on Israel began from Hamas in Gaza. They've been talking to people on all sides of the divide, investigating how universities have responded, how powerful interests have joined the fray, and how the conflict over the conflict ultimately spiraled out of control. We're joined by the director and producer, correspondent for Frontline, James Jacoby. And if you get a question, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And we have Eric on the line. And Eric, you're on the air.
Actually, it's me, Alex.
Okay, Alex, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, might have had the name mistaken. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
I would just like to say that we shouldn't ascribe inherent meanings to any of these phrases. You can draw several implications from any of the chants being used. And it's an unfair jump in logic to jump from the mantra, like from the river to the sea, to assume exactly what politics it would take. Although that's a legitimate claim rooted in the history of Palestinian dispossession. People who are supportive of the Israeli state will evoke the imagery of Jews being pushed into the sea because it's provocative and emotionally charged. But that's an image in the imagination used for propaganda, and it's not actual politics. We're not going to be the ones that decide how Palestinians will be liberated. We shouldn't pretend that our words on this side of the U.S. will decide things, although I think students are trying to find legitimate ways to unpack their state's responsibility in maintaining an apartheid system. So main point is that these phrases don't have inherent meanings. They're discursive, but emphasizing the discourse here rather than the genocide over there is a distraction.
Well, Alex, so you're saying the chants have no meaning, so we should ignore them?
No, not necessarily that they have no meaning, just that they have no inherent meaning and that they're contested. And, you know, we won't flow directly from the chants to, like, actual negotiations and politics, and we should stop pretending like the jump from the mantra to the politics is automatic.
Okay. Well, thank you, Alex, for that. And James Jacoby, the director, producer, correspondent for Frontline, any response?
Yeah, I mean, I think Alex represents certainly a prevailing point of view among the protesters that we shouldn't jump to conclusions that these are genocidal chants and kind of draw any larger implication, and that we don't know what's in the heart of these protesters who are chanting it. I would say that, you know, to reiterate a point I made earlier, they are chanting these things, and I understand the protesters' point of view that they don't want to distract from what's happening in Gaza, but I have spoken to protesters who have said we don't want to chant these things because these chants are controversial. They bring too much attention to us and what we're chanting as opposed to the conflict that they're trying to draw attention to. So,
well, they're not chanting peace now. We want peace, peace,
right.
Peace. Please stop fighting. They're chanting something that's very provocative. And then we have other protests, different types of people protesting, and they'll say things that are extremely racist and violent and call for, hurting African-American communities. And if they, you know, would you say the same thing? Would you say, well, those chants don't mean anything? You know, is there any?
I'm certainly not. I'm not in the camp of saying that those chants don't mean anything. That was your caller, Alex.
Yeah,
who said
I know.
That. But I think I'm just saying that that is a prevalent way of thinking about this. And I'm also saying that there are plenty of people that are in the kind of pro-Palestinian movement that find these chants problematic because, in fact, there's been so much conversation about the chants that it has actually taken attention away from calls for a ceasefire, for instance, and what's happening in Gaza right now. So I understand their perspective as well.
Okay, let's go to another caller. We have Reggie, and Reggie, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yeah, hi, Reggie, you there? Ready to go?
Yeah, I'm here. So my question was, why can't we just see things from both perspectives? I mean, I feel like, you know, a lot of the students, they're on the side that they're pro-Palestinian and they are not necessarily for Hamas. However, like you said, like this, your guest said that when we see, we're only seeing it from one perspective, and it appears that the Israelis are the bully or the dominant person in the conflict. For instance, I'm 6'2", 220 pounds. If a woman came and slapped me and I beat her down to a pulp, the response is disproportionate. So, of course, a lot of the students probably feel that Israelis are on the aggressor in this situation. So, I mean, why can't it be both sides? And I'll take my comment after here.
All right, Reggie, thank you for that. So one great point that you make, James, is the generational difference in views about how people perceive Israel. Older generations, like myself, we remember Israel, you know, fighting for its existence. Younger generational people might see it as a bully nation. So you cover that.
Yes, we do. We do cover that. And of course, not everybody who's of an older generation sees Israel as just an underdog. And as the caller said, or the previous caller talked about, you know, there was the dispossession of, you know, among Palestinians. And it's been a very conflicted history. But I think that it's fair to say that a lot of people of an older generation appreciated the fact that Israel has been, you know, there's been wars that have been started by other countries in the region several times, and it's been attacked. And I think, in terms of what this film is, we're talking about what's happening mm-hmm. on campuses. I would direct that caller to any number of front lines that have been done about the history of the Israel-Palestinian conflict and how complex and that is. And it's very difficult, I think, at this point to talk in terms of oppressor and oppressed and to see the world in that binary. I think that especially when it comes to this conflict, that flattens out too much complexity.
Also in the documentary, A Crisis on Campus, you look at how in Washington, D.C., and Republicans, they have gone onto this looking at investigating it. And there was a hearing. Representative Virginia Fox, North Carolina Republican, she led this hearing. Let's give a listen.
Today, each of you will have a chance to answer to and atone for the many specific instances of vitriolic, hate-filled anti-Semitism on your respective campuses.
All of the presidents denounced anti-Semitism.
There is no place for anti-Semitism at Harvard.
All supported Israel's right to exist.
Do you believe that Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish nation?
Absolutely. Israel has the right to exist.
Many of the questions also reflected a much broader set of conservative concerns about the direction of higher education.
What is the percentage of conservative professors at your institutions?
Would you allow President Trump, who is a graduate of UPenn, to speak at UPenn if a student group invited him?
But the five-hour hearing would be remembered for the president's responses to a hypothetical question posed by Representative Elise Stefanik, herself a Harvard graduate.
Does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Penn's rules or code of conduct? Yes or no?
If the speech turns into conduct, it can be harassment. Yes.
Throughout the exchange, the president struggled to explain the legal challenge of determining when protected free speech, however abhorrent, crosses the line into intimidation and harassment.
So, James, how did this go so badly for those university presidents who lost their jobs?
Well, as Carol Crist, the now outgoing chancellor of UC Berkeley, puts it, these presidents kind of came in prepared for a legal deposition, and instead they should have prepared for a Broadway play or Broadway show. I think they misunderstood the nature of the exchange in these congressional hearings, where they came in thinking that they were going to talk about how the sort of legal complexities for them of both kind of giving students the right to free speech on campuses, but also balancing that with what is a federal law obligation that they have to protect students on their campuses from harassment and discrimination based on ethnicity. And that is a central tension that explains some of the reactions of these administrations to these protests on their campuses, that they're kind of, there's a bind that they're in and a dilemma between free speech rights and these legal obligations to protect students from harassment. And that's a central theme of the film. And I think in that congressional hearing, Claudine Gay, Liz McGill, and Dr. Kornbluth at MIT, they all were trying to explain that legal complexity, and that really wasn't what kind of what that hearing called for.
Should be noted that Representative Fox showed little concern for anti-Semitism when white supremacists marched across the University of Virginia campus chanting, "Jews will not replace us." In fact, that committee actively denied Democrats' request for a hearing on that. So it does seem like it's selective outrage about concerns about anti-Semitism by some of these Republican officeholders.
It didn't make it in the film because we only have 51 minutes to tell a rather big story. But I did, in my interview with Virginia Fox, I did ask her about that. And I believe she said, "What anti-Semitism on the right?"
All right. We'll talk more about that when we come back from the break. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues right after this. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the new Frontline documentary, airs tonight, 9 p.m. Central Time. It's called Crisis on Campus, about the protest on college campuses, dividing student bodies, leading to arrest. Frontline on PBS with Retro Report gives us an inside story about what's driving these protests. You can call in 833-877-8255, and let's go to Kamala. Kamala, you're on the air. Kamala.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this important topic. As an alumnus of UT and as a college teacher, I want to offer my immense gratitude to the students who have been standing up for Palestinian liberation and for ceasefire and for the removal of our support for weapons that are killing tens of thousands of people. As a person of Mennonite background, I wanted to mention that two of the Mennonite schools were, my alma mater, were among the first to ring bells for people who have died in Gaza and Palestine and throughout the area, and who have also declared their their universities or colleges do not invest in companies that are benefiting from the mm-hmm. Israeli weapons.
Kamala, thank you for that. James Jacoby, I want to go back to when we were talking about before with the college professors getting grilled on Capitol Hill by Virginia Fox on that committee. And so this became so controversial and it took on a life of its own, even invaded the popular culture. I want to listen. This is just from Saturday Night Live and how they took that on.
I yield my time back to Ms. Stefanik.
Here today because hate speech has no place on college campuses. Hate speech belongs in Congress, on Elon Musk's Twitter, in private dinners with my donors, and in public speeches by my work husband, Donald Trump. So, Dr. Gay, simple question. Is it acceptable for students to use anti-Semitic language?
On this subject, I'd like to speak not from the heart, but from the thesaurus. That type of hateful speech is personally abhorrent to me.
And could you rephrase that in an even more academic way?
Sure. That variety of odious oration is vis-a-vis me repugnant.
Now, what measures are you taking to protect Jewish students at Harvard?
We're taking precautions to protect all students. Jewish students, Muslim students.
Again, just the first one.
So, James, popular humor is picking apart the tone deafness of the college president speaking from the thesaurus, but also looking at what could be seen as the hypocrisy of the lawmakers only caring about certain things at certain times when it's their to their political advantage. But they do talk about the need for respecting free speech on college campuses. So, is free speech on college campuses, is this a test like we've not seen in the generations for free speech on college campuses?
Yeah, I think this is a serious test. I would say, though, I mean, I appreciate the satire of Saturday Night Live, but I do think that this was more than just Republicans calling this hearing and advancing kind of their own agenda. This was There's bipartisan concern about anti-Semitism on campuses, and I do think that it stems, you know, not just out of political expedience, but also genuine concern about things. And of course, you know, we can talk about hypocrisy, but I think, again, that wasn't in the purview of what we were doing here. It was much more about how the schools were responding to this, including the political pressure. So it was bipartisan pressure, and obviously SNL spoofed the Republicans there. But I do think that this is a massive test of free speech on campus. Again, this test of whether this speech crosses a line into harassment. And the law isn't very clear. It hasn't really been adjudicated in certain ways. So there's something called Title VI. It's part of the Civil Rights Act. And it has been actually expanded to include anti-Semitism. And basically it's about protecting students, and that schools have an obligation to protect students from harassment and intimidation based on ethnicity. And this is a very serious issue for these schools because both there's congressional investigations, the Department of Education is investigating these schools for Title VI violations, and there are lawsuits at a number of schools, both from Jewish students and from Palestinian students, for these schools having failed to protect them from discrimination based on ethnicity.
Yeah, I saw that in the report, and I was really wondering, like, what's that going to be like moving forward? You know, both sides are claiming that they have been discriminated against. I don't know if that's a sign of that they're doing something right, that both sides are feeling like they're victims here?
Yes, certainly both sides are, and I'm sure that there's incidents that both sides can speak to that are either, you know, discriminatory, harassment, intimidation, and I think that these legal mechanisms, both the Department of Education as well as these civil lawsuits, you know, we'll see how these shake out and where the courts kind of stand on this. But it's as I said, the schools really don't know where the line is on some of these things. And I think the schools have tried to veer much more toward free speech on these issues. Now, of course, this also comes in the context, this greater social context of the past 10 or 15 years in which on campuses, there's been a push toward kind of making sure that students feel included, right, and are sensitive to certain things, especially identity issues. So, for instance, you know, trigger warnings and sensitivities to certain identities on these campuses. And so I think that that's also kind of coming in that context as well, because these schools have really bent over backwards to make all students feel in some ways included. And I think that for the Jewish students right now, like if they've bent over backwards to make all different types of students included, then why wouldn't they want to do the same for Jewish students? And the same goes for Palestinian students, or pro-Palestinian students. So it's a very complex mix of things, and it will be very interesting to see how this plays out when it comes to these legal cases and investigations.
Let's go to a last caller, Bonnie. And Bonnie, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to date myself here and say I remember protests against South African government for apartheid. And thanks to President Jimmy Carter, the label apartheid has been applied to Israel's action towards the Palestinians. And I would suggest that everyone who's protesting on college campuses might direct their efforts towards divesting of any investment in Israel.
All right, Bonnie, thank you for that. But those protests, anti-apartheid protests, which I remember, I mean, it was students versus the administration, not students versus students. And you draw that line in the documentary, James, and Crisis on Campus, that this is student versus student, and that's different.
Yes, and in fact, it's Carol Crist, who's, again, the chancellor at UC Berkeley, who makes that point, and that she's drawing the distinction between this moment of protest on campuses versus, for instance, the anti-apartheid protests in the 80s and certainly the late 60s against the Vietnam War. And she's saying that now it's student against student, faculty against faculty, and there isn't unity among the students and faculty kind of fighting the administration. But to the caller's point, I mean, one of the main demands that preceded October 7th and has certainly intensified since October 7th in the pro-Palestinian movement is this divestment movement. And of course, this divestment is you know, has been debated for years. I think that what's new about it is that it's been wrapped up now in the calls for ceasefire. And again, I just think that we need to kind of acknowledge the complexity of all this and that we can't kind of broad brush what this movement is.
Well, it wasn't you didn't talk about it, but there were signs in the video of people blaming Joe Biden for what's going on. You didn't talk about the politics at all. But there is some concern that he could get some splash damage from this.
Absolutely. We didn't get into that. Again, it was unfortunately we've got limited time, you know, 51 minutes to tell a very complicated story. I wish we could get in everything. But I certainly think that this movement will have some sort of effect on the electoral politics this year. Students, some are drawing a parallel to 1968 and Humphrey versus Nixon, and that that in some ways Nixon was elected in part because of the movements at that time, and that in some ways Joe Biden may be facing something similar now. I don't really want to weigh in on, but I certainly think that it's a factor to watch.
Yeah, both national conventions will be in Chicago, so we'll see how that goes. Hopefully this won't be as crazy as it was in 68. James Jacoby, thank you so much for joining us. The director, producer, correspondent for Frontline, latest film with Frontline is Crisis on Campus, airs at 9 o'clock tonight on PBS stations. And you can catch it on streaming after the broadcast on the PBS app, on YouTube, and on their website. James, so good to talk to you again.
Thank you so much, David.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.